This is the sixth day of this November 2016 7-day session. We'll return to our text of yesterday, a book called The Practice of Zen by C.C. Chang. A 1959 book. And we'll go back to the discourses of Chan Master Shu Yun. And this is from a 7-day session, we would say. The year, we don't know, but it was January. Would have had to have been before 1959. January... January. Alright. And we'll pick up where we left off. When you are meditating in the sitting posture, you should never bring the koan up too high. If you bring it up too much, you will get a headache. So this is a problem for some people, more than a few people, is having the koan, the mu, or the whatever this koan is, to having it in the head. The worst mistake is to think one could figure out a koan. Your head does you no good with resolving a koan. It only causes problems. That's why we say, for whether it's koan or breath, anything. You want to find your center. You're working in from the center down in the lower belly. And if you do try to question from your head, then every once in a while someone can get a headache. Nor should you place the koan in your chest. If you do, you will you will feel uncomfortable and suffer a pain there. What you should do is watch the word who. He's talking about the koan. Who is the one who seeks the Buddha's name? What is it exactly? Elsewhere, it's to who is the one who calls, who is the one who recites the name of Buddha, who is the one who calls the Buddha's name. It's for people who weren't hearing this yesterday, it's taking the formula used in the Pure Land School of reciting or calling the Buddha Amida's name, and then converting it into a Zen practice with the making it into a question. Who is the one? Who is actually the one who's reciting the Buddha's name? So, in that context, he says, what you should do is watch the word who softly and gently with a smooth mind and calm, steady breath, like that of a hen as she hatches her egg or a cat when she watches a mouse. So, of course, you do the same with mu. What is this? Who am I? If you can do this well, you will find that one of these days your life root will suddenly and abruptly break off. Life root would be basic... Our root craving to be, our craving to to have and to be and to get, which is seen as the sort of the engine of rebirth endlessly through this world of suffering. It's another way of talking about enlightenment. One of these days, your life route will suddenly and abruptly break off. And now we're into the fourth day of this January session. Now 3 days of the seven have already passed. I am glad you are all working so hard. Some of you have brought me some poems and stanzas you have composed and asked me to comment on them. Some of you say that you saw voidness and light and so on. Well, these are not bad things, but judging from them, I am sure that you must have forgotten all that I told you in the first 2 days. I could already hear people saying, oh, should I be composing stanzas to give to Roshi? Last night I told you that to practice the way is nothing more than to follow and to recognize the way. What is the way? To look into the koan, which is like a royal sword. With it you kill the Buddha when Buddha comes. With it you slaughter the devil when the devil comes. This means, of course, that you use the koan to cut off all thoughts, including thoughts, even thoughts of the Buddha, certainly of enlightenment, and any other thoughts. Under this sword, not a single idea is allowed to remain. Not a solitary dharma is permitted to exist. How is it possible, then, to have so much distracted thought that you compose poems and stanzas and see visions of light and void? If you keep on doing this sort of thing, you will, in time, completely forget your koan. Now remember, to work on the koan is to look into it continuously without a single moment of interruption. Like the river ever flowing on, the mind should always be lucid and aware. All ideas of samsara and nirvana should be wiped out. As the great Zen master Huang Po said, and here's his verse, to practice the way is like defending the forbidden royal palace under invasion. Guard it closely with your life, and fight for it with all your might. Behold, if the freezing cold has not yet penetrated to the core of your bones, how can it be possible for you to smell the fresh fragrance of the blooming plum blossoms? This is a verse that under different translation I've offered in the Zendo and before me Roshi Kaplo. The translation I remember is, without a whole spell of cold that bites into your bones, how could the plum blossoms regale you with their piercing fragrance? He's not just talking about winter, literally. Without this work, without stripping away all of these mental accretions, without going to the bottom, how can we know the joy of spring? There's a long paragraph here about the eight consciousnesses, the eight levels of consciousness, which most of you have heard of a number of times in Taisho. I think it's too abstract to be useful in Sesshin, so I'm going to skip that. It's just Buddhist psychology, and the different ways of different aspects of consciousness. And we'll go on to this next paragraph. the master who first established the Shirtan monastery trained under many different masters, traveling from one place to another. He was a very ardent person, working on his Zen all the time. One night he stayed in an inn and heard a girl who was a tofu maker singing the following song in an adjacent room while she was making tofu. Now, this is kind of a quirky little song, I'll read it as it says. The translator makes it bean cake, but it really means like a tofu cake. I'll just say tofu. So this girl is singing this song. Oh, Chang is the tofu, and Li is also the tofu. At night when you lay your head down upon your pillow, a thousand thoughts may arise in your mind, but when you awake in the morning, you still continue to make tofu. Chang and Li are two of the most common names in China. It'd be like Jones and Smith. So Jones is the tofu, Smith is the tofu. At night when you lay down your head upon your pillow, a thousand thoughts may arise in your mind, but when you awake in the morning, you still continue to make tofu. And then Shu Yun says, this Zen master was absorbed in meditation when the girl sang the song. Upon hearing it, he suddenly awoke to realization. From this story, we know that Zen practice need not necessarily be carried out in the temples or meditation halls. Anywhere and everywhere one can reach enlightenment if he can concentrate his mind on the work without being sidetracked by other things. There are so many enlightenment accounts in which what triggered the enlightenment, such as this master hearing this verse, what triggered it is, it's hard to understand why that would trigger the opening. I mean, you could look at this and do a kind of interpretation of things, you know, waking up and the continuity between the previous day making tofu and then coming, waking up and making more tofu, or getting caught in your thoughts, but still then emerging from your thoughts and coming back to just the work. But none of that was going on in this master's mind when he heard this. His mind was absolutely empty. It had to have been. To come to awakening, the mind has to be free of thoughts. Wide open. So it's beyond explanation. Something triggered something. Maybe from his past, his conditioning, something cultural. It doesn't matter. And these things don't just happen in Asia. They happen here. Not all awakening experiences happen in Sesshin. Most, yes, but not all. And now he skips to the last day of this Sesshin, January 23rd. The master addressed the disciples as follows. This is the last day of our two periods of 7 days meditation. I congratulate you all on being able to complete the task. Today I shall investigate your Zen work and see whether you have gained any realization or improvement. You should stand up and, in plain and honest words, announce your understandings and experiences to all. Now, anyone who has become enlightened, please stand up and say something. Long time passed and no one stood up. The master said nothing and walked out of the Zen hall. this last sentence. Somehow it's so pregnant with meaning. A long time passed and no one stood up. And then the master said nothing and walked out of the Zen hall. What is behind that nothing? Disappointment? Maybe a little. But mostly, it's just nothing. This is the way it is. This is how this one turned out. To skip some 50 pages and pull out one of several brief biographical accounts. This one is by a Zen master, Wu Wen. It's called Zen Master Wu Wen's Story. And I chose it because it's just about the right length of the time we have remaining. When I first saw Master Dao Wang, he taught me to work on the koan, "It is neither mind nor Buddha nor anything." This one is in the Mumonkan, and sometimes would be used as a first breakthrough koan. "It is neither mind nor Buddha nor anything." Later, Yun Feng and Yue Shan and I, with several others, vowed to help each other in our striving for the ultimate enlightenment. Still later, I went to see Huai Shi, who taught me to work on the Mu word. The word here is Wu, but I'll use the Japanese version, Mu. Then I journeyed to Changlu, where I practiced with my companion. When I met Qin of Hui Shang, he asked me, "You have practiced for 6 or 7 years now. What have you understood?" I answered, "Every day I just feel that there is nothing in my mind." Seeing that I had no true understanding, he asked, "From what source has your understanding been derived?" I was not sure whether I really knew the truth or not, so I dared not answer. He then said to me, "You can hold to your work in quietness, but you lose it during activity." This alarmed me, for he had hit upon my weak spot. "What should one do," I asked, "to understand this matter?" Qin answered, "Have you never heard what Chung Lao Zi said?" And here's the little verse. "To understand this, face south to see the Dipper." My guess is that it's referring to the Big Dipper, which I guess is north, the northern skies. That would give it the contradictory quality of a koan. "To understand this, face south to see the Dipper." Upon saying this, he left me abruptly. As a result, I became unconscious of walking when I walked and of sitting when I sat. Let me just stop here. The fact that he dove into this little koan-like thing shows how much faith he had in this guy who gave it to him. And And then this state he describes, becoming unconscious of walking when I walked and of sitting when I sat. This is a temporary state, a samadhi-like state that one can reach in working on a koan, a simple koan like that. This is not mindfulness. Mindfulness is something else. Mindfulness is awareness of phenomena outside oneself and within oneself, mental and physical phenomena. And that is very important, that mindfulness. But one can work oneself into this no-minded state where, according to another source, when lowering your head, you don't see the ground, and when raising your head, you don't see the sky. I've been asked every once in a while by people who say, well, why would I want to be like that? How can I function in my life with that kind of closed off to everything except the koan? Well, you can't, really. If you have a job, you can't. But in Sesshin, one can go into this state and in a monastery, I suppose, one could pull it off. But in any case, it's just temporary. It's a phase that one can sometimes goes through before breaking through that kind of trance. I put aside the practice on the Mu koan for a week and concentrated my mind on trying to understand what in heaven's name he had meant by facing south to see the Dipper. One day when I came to the hall of service and sat with a group of monks, the doubt sensation stuck with me and refused to dissolve. So he couldn't dislodge this question. It wasn't that he had to work on it. He was trying to work on it. It was working on him. He couldn't put it down. It wouldn't put him down. It's a very promising state to reach. The time for dinner came and passed. Suddenly I felt my mind become bright, void, light, and transparent. My human thoughts broke into pieces like skin peeling, as if I had merged in the void, and I saw neither person nor thing appearing before me. I returned to consciousness about half an hour later and found that my body was running with sweat. Immediately I understood the meaning of seeing the Dipper by facing south. I went to see Chin. Whatever questions he put to me, I could answer without hindrance or difficulty. Also, I could compose stanzas freely and effortlessly. However, I still had not stripped myself to the point of reaching the state of, quote, leaping one step upward. So maybe this is a kind of a light Kensho that he had experienced, just a little tenuous opening, but he recognized that it was not yet the real thing. Later I went to Shang Yen's place in the mountains to spend the summer. The mosquitoes which infested the region bit me terribly. I had to move my hands continually to keep them away. And then I thought, if the men in ancient times had sacrificed their bodies for the sake of the Dharma, should I be afraid of mosquito bites? With this in mind, I tried to relax and endure the pests. With fists clenched and teeth tight, I concentrated my mind solely on the Mu word, bearing the continuously repeated bites of the mosquitoes with the utmost patience. Soon I felt both my mind and body sink quietly down like a house whose four walls had fallen. The state was like the voidness. No attribute can be described to it. I had sat down in the early morning, and it was not until afternoon that I arose from this period of meditation. Thereupon I knew for certain that the Dharma never misleads us or lets us down. I've told the story that I heard from Roshi Kaplow about his first teacher, Harada Roshi, which Harada Roshi told him, Kaplow-san, in the 1950s, about having done a similar thing. He was so determined to come to awakening, to break through his koan, that he went into a bamboo grove, a swampy bamboo grove, in the middle of summer, knowing what awaited him there. He went in dressed in only a loincloth and folded up his legs, and like the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, he made a resolve not to leave there till he had broken through Mu. And the mosquitoes descended on him in clouds. He said that the itching was so hideous that he had no choice but to go deep into the hara, deep into the practice, into the mu. It was his escape from the itching. And we can use practice this way. It's the same with the stick. If it's too painful, then the usefulness is it can drive us deeper into concentration on the practice. Anyway, that, according to Roshi Kaplow, was when Harada Roshi had his first Kensho. It's the same with pain in the legs. We read I commented on this clause in Xu Yun's account when he says, when beginners first practice Zen, they always have difficulty in subduing their ever-flowing errant thoughts, and they suffer the miseries of pain in their legs. I commented because I'd never run across any reference to leg pain in any of the texts that I can remember. And there too, if you're not doing damage, if it's not a shooting, stabbing pain, then that pain can be used very powerfully to concentrate the mind, to get more deeply into the practice. Many people have had the experience of using pain in that way and later saying, I don't think I ever would have gotten as deep into my practice without the pain if I had somehow found another way around the pain, but instead gone through it. And then he concludes by saying, although my understanding was then quite clear, it had not yet come to the point of full maturity. I still possessed a slight, subtle, hidden, and unnoticeable wrong thoughts which had not been completely exhausted. This such thoughts, these subtle, deeply ingrained thought forms, we don't really discover except afterward when we realize we had them. And he does say, unconscious, unnoticeable, slight, subtle, hidden, and unnoticeable wrong thoughts. Well, if they're unnoticeable, then we don't notice them. We don't know they're there until later when we have a deeper insight, and then we see that we have been carrying these misconceptions with us, and that those, and that they had been hindering us. Going to the mountain at Kung Chau, I meditated for 6 years there, for another 6 on the mountain of Luhan, and for 3 more at Kwang Chau. Not until then did I gain my emancipation. This is a classic Zen master aspiration, is to never be satisfied with even genuine awakening experiences. Needing, not even telling oneself one should go further, but needing to go further, feeling dissatisfied, yet still dissatisfied with what one has realized. That dissatisfaction is wonderful karma. Most people would think it's the worst thing to not be satisfied with what one has realized, but then it leads one on further, deeper. And one more master's story here. This is a Zen master Cao Feng's story. To understand this matter requires great determination and earnestness, for as soon as you have them, the real doubt sensation will arise. At times you will doubt this and doubt that. Again, doubt always means question, wondering. The doubt automatically and instinctively arising by itself. From dawn to dusk, it sticks to you from your head to your feet. It becomes one whole continuous piece which will not be dislodged no matter how hard you attempt to shake it. Even though you try to push it away, it will still persist in sticking to you. At all times, it manifests itself clearly before you. By the way, this state it's not necessary to reach this state of intense doubt to have a first opening to get through one's koan. Or even if one, to reach this state of this doubt mass, it doesn't need to take long. Now this is when you can progress. On reaching this stage, one should keep his mind straight and refrain from having secondary thoughts. When one finds himself not knowing that he is walking while walking, or sitting while sitting, and unconscious of cold, heat, hunger, then he is about to reach home. Henceforth, he will be able to catch up and hold on. He does not have to do anything but wait until the time comes. But do not let this remark influence you to wait idly, nor excite you to exert yourself, striving for such a state with anxious mind. That's the grasping mind that we talked about earlier in Sesshin. Nor should you just let go and give up. Rather, you should preserve your mindfulness, keeping it steady until you reach enlightenment. Let's go back to this admonition to keep the mind straight and refrain from having secondary thoughts. Well, any thoughts are going to be secondary. Thoughts about what one is experiencing. Thoughts about one's practice. Thoughts about progress. Thoughts about what might come. And above all, thoughts about oneself having the experience. At times you will encounter 84,000 soldier demons waiting their chance before the gate of your six organs, the six senses. The projections of your mind will appear before you in the guise of good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, strange or astonishing visions. The slightest clinging to these things will entrap you into enslavement to their commands and directions. You will then talk and act as a devil. This is something that happened yesterday in Taisho, a mild version of that. At such a time, you should refrain from stirring up your mind and should make yourself like a living corpse. Then, as you hold on and on, suddenly and abruptly, you will feel as though you were being crushed to pieces. You will then reach a state which will frighten the heavens and shake the earth. I know that these kinds of accounts can be disquieting to some people, even frightening. There's nothing to be frightened of. This is the most wonderful turn of events. To make yourself like a living corpse. And that means not becoming distracted by things around you. This means the utmost stability, unshakable concentration. He goes on, I was ordained at 20, staying at the monastery of Qinzu. I vowed to accomplish Zen within 3 years. First, I worked under Master Tuan Chao. He taught me to work on the koan, where was I before birth, and where will I be after death? I followed his instructions and practiced, but could not concentrate my mind because of the bifurcation in this very koan. So bifurcation, I've not seen it before in this two-part way. Usually it's what was my face before my parents gave birth to me, or what is my original mind? But then to split it this way into where was I before birth and where will I be after death? That would be tough. He said my mind was also scattered. Later I saw Master Shui Yan. He taught me to work on the koan mu. He also asked me to report to him each day. Explaining that this was like setting out on a journey, he said one should find out every day what progress one had made. Because his explanations were so systematic and understandable, I became so dependent on him that I did not make any effort in my own work. Roshi Kapo used to quote this favorite saying in Japanese Zen, never explain. And there is merit in that, as we see here. He became too dependent on his teacher's explanations. But there is a place for explaining. It just has to be used in the right place, the right time. I did not make any effort in my own work. One day, when I had just entered his room, he said to me, "Who has dragged this corpse here for you?" He had hardly finished this sentence when he chased me out of his room. Later, I followed the example of Qin Shan and stayed in the meditation hall. One day, in a dream, I suddenly remembered the koan, "All things are reducible to the One, but to what is the One reducible?" It's sort of the Zen version of God made everything, but what made God? At that moment, a doubt sensation abruptly arose within me so that I did not know east from west or north from south. During the sixth day in this state, while I was chanting with the assembly, I lifted my head and saw the last two sentences of the stanza composed by the fifth patriarch. And this is the verse. Oh, it is you, the fellow I have known all the time, who goes and returns in the 30,000 days of 100 years. Immediately I broke up the sentence, who has dragged this corpse here for you? For it had stuck in my mind since the day the Master had put it before me. I felt as if my spirit had been extinguished and my mind blown away and then revived again from death itself. It was like dropping the burden of a carrying pole weighing 20 pounds. I was then 24 years old and so had achieved my original wish to realize Zen within 3 years. Afterwards, I was asked, can you master yourself in the bright daytime? I answered, yes, I can. Can you master yourself when dreaming? Again, my answer was, yes, I can. Where in dreamless sleep is the master? To this question, I had no answer or explanation. The master said to me, from now on, I do not want you to practice the Dharma or learn. No, I do not want you to study Buddhism or learn the Dharma, nor to study anything, either old or new. I just want you to eat when you are hungry and to sleep when you are tired. As soon as you wake from sleep, alert your mind and ask yourself, who is the very master of this awakening and where does he rest his body and lead his life? I then made up my mind that I would understand this thing in one way or another, even though it meant that I should appear to be an idiot for the rest of my life. 5 years passed. 5 years passed. One day when I was questioning this matter while sleeping, my brother monk, who slept beside me in the dormitory, pushed his pillow so that it fell with a heavy thump to the floor. At that moment, my doubts were suddenly broken up. I felt as if I had jumped out of a trap. All the puzzling koans of the masters and the Buddhas and all the different issues and events of both present and ancient times became transparently clear to me. Henceforth, all things were settled. Nothing under the sun remained but peace. We'll stop now and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I vow to liberate endless blind Asha, and I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind Asha, and I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind Asha, and I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to
Requiem Lura Aim Aum Tuvatam.